welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams. Today on the show, we got Thomas TJ Flippin. All right, he calls himself TJ. His friends call him TJ. I think you can all call him TJ from now, too. I'm going to try and make friends with him. All right, because he works right up here at Diller Quail School. And he gets off at 6 on Fridays. and we're going to try and make it work. We're going to try and make something beautiful blossom and meet up here pretty soon. And he's an African-American guitarist as well, which is this is the first time this has happened on this show. So it's an exciting day. He has a duo. It's called Duo Noir with Christopher Mallett. Him and Christopher unearth the music of a little-known composer. We go into that. And Thomas's face is gracing the cover of Soundboard magazine this month. So he's that guy. If you want to get an idea of what he looks like that. And he's a great guy. Super good guest. Exactly the kind of guest I look for on this show. And I hope you guys enjoy it. The show is sponsored by SavageClassical.com. That's S-A-V-A-G-E, Classical.com. You can go there. And Richard, you could, you know, wheel and deal with Richard and try to get him to come down on, you know, a very expensive guitar and see what you come up with. That's my read for today, folks. You know, you know, I mean, that's it. That's all I got. Wait. Let's check it out. Savage Classical. You know what he does? He does a blog. You should read his blog. He talks about what he's doing. He takes beautiful videos of the guitars. You know, this day and age, it's easy to kind of get an idea of what the guitar looks like and feels like with, you know, all these high definition cameras and gadgets that you can sync on them. And yeah, you go there. It's S-A-V-A, how do you spell Savage? S-A-V-A-G-E, classical.com. All right, go to his blog. Let's see what his blog says. I've been having a problem reading lately, but I think it's just because the last thing I read was in italics. Let's see, what does he say? Video work. Tons of video work and recording planned this month with great artists such as Gohar Vardanyan. That's a friend of the show. With permission of Strings by Mail. Almost a friend of the show, Strings by Mail. I still like him. John still writes a nice little letter whenever I order something from him. So, you know, they almost sponsored the show, but we were a little too raunchy for them. he was on the verge. He was on the verge. And then something happened where he wanted me to change the copy in an ad that I was going to put in GFA. It said, it called guitarist troubled. And it said the guitarist luthiers and other troubled personalities that grace the guitar universe. And he said that I shouldn't call him troubled. And I said, no deal. But we still get along anyway. I think he just wants more of a wholesome thing. So if any of you are out there with a wholesome podcast, you know, talking about how great everybody is, reach out. Maybe Strings by Mail will sponsor you. Updates below as they are produced by Savage Classical Guitar Studios and Steamwalker Studios. That's cool. Steamwalker. It's a cool name for a studio, huh? Steamwalker. I was supposed to play... I just got the news that I can't have my board game night tonight. Everybody canceled. No one can do it. That makes me sad. I got a great Star Wars game. It's a great way to escape my dark life right now. And believe me, it is dark. I just re-recorded this intro. The first one I recorded, I sounded like a sad, hurt little puppy. And I deleted it. It was just me whining about the fact that I've been reaching out to presenters and managers and getting nothing for the last 2 months. Ah, you know? So I decided I would just shorten that segment a little bit and get on with the interview instead of putting you through me complaining and telling you guys that I may quit soon. And I might quit soon. You know, I might. I might. I've just about had this. A fellow can only take so much rejection. But anyway, so, you know, everything else is good. I've started, walking to work instead of riding my bike. And that's been kind of nice. I'm seeing the city in a way that I haven't seen it in several years. I've ridden my bike to work for the last, I think, seven or eight years. I've ridden my bike to work every day, rain or snow. And this season has been so bad in New York. It's, you know, record temperatures and record lows and a lot of snow and a lot of rain and a lot of slush. And I just was like, I can't do this. Can't do it anymore. I'm 38 now. I'm a little too old for this shit. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to, you know, walk to work and I've been doing it. I've been walking across the park to work. I have to give myself a full hour. So that cuts into my time, but, you know, it's safer and it makes me feel like an adult and I show up a little less winded and a little less angry. And that's always great when you're working with kids. This show's not great when you're working with kids. I actually had the first kid find out about the show, and it's scary, man. It's scary. You know, especially last week's episode was Dominic Frasca. You know, why couldn't you have figured out the show when it was Jerry Willard? You know? So, you know, a kid has to sit there and find out when Dominic Frasca's on the show. And the kid goes, "Hey, Brett," in front of my guitar ensemble, "you should tell everybody about your podcast." And I said, "What podcast?" And I just gave him a look. And he goes, "The one." And I was like, "I don't have a pod. That's a different Brett Williams you're thinking of." And he goes, "Oh, okay." And I talked to him after class and I said, "Look, buddy," you know, because he was scared. I was like, "This is not your fault at all. It's my fault. You know, this is something." I tried to explain it to him the best I could. I told him, I said, "You know, you can talk to whoever you want about it. You shouldn't feel like you can't talk to people about it, but you really should understand that you probably should try, for my sake, if you want to do me a solid, try not to talk to other kids about it. And also, you shouldn't be listening to it. It says on there, it's explicit. It says that kids shouldn't be listening." And especially the Dominic Frasca episode, I made a real big effort. It's kind of funny that the one episode that I actually make an effort to address the fact that children shouldn't be listening to this show, the next week, a 10-year-old comes up to me and starts talking about the show in front of other 10-year-olds. I mean, it's bad. This show, let me reiterate, is not for children. It's important that we keep this show for the parents that are listening, you know, maybe the parents of this kid or the parents of the other kids that are finding out about this and maybe want to use this as leverage against me if I ever need to discipline their kid or kick their kid out of an ensemble or whatever it is you want to use this against me for. Just understand the importance of having an open discussion between artists and what that serves. And the way to do that is for me to be open. And if I'm open and if I say shit, then it makes other people feel like they can be open and say shit too. And then if everybody is saying what they want, I think the dialogue goes into places that are deeper and more meaningful for the listeners and for everybody else. So, you know, with the understanding that I may have some parents listening to this show, that you guys understand that your children are not supposed to be listening to this show. It is, you know, I lose listeners. I lose listeners. Because I say that the show is explicit. I've gotten emails from people telling me that that they would listen to the show, but that it's explicit and that they don't appreciate bad language. So there are, I am paying the price for having an explicit show already. And the only reason that I call it an explicit show is to protect the feelings of the parents and the children that I work with and that know my work and that you know, follow me. So as much as I appreciate you guys and as much as I love the kids, it's really important that this show is not shared with them and that I don't have to feel self-conscious about what I'm talking about and that my guests don't feel self-conscious about what they're talking about. So just addressing that one more time, and then I'll never bring it up again. But that, you know, that was a kind of a scary moment because I certainly, you know, as much as I talk about how difficult it is working in schools and as much as I talk about how mistreated we are as teachers and as much as I talk about the difficulties that we have with parents, with guests on the show, because oftentimes they are very difficult. You know, it's a job that I kind of like, and it's a job that I've gotten good at, and it's a job that I can do, and it's a job that I've sustained now for about 8 or 9 years at this one institution. And so I hope that I can, you know, keep on working there for a long time, unless I quit and go into something completely different. Then the show's going to go off the rails. Anyway, let's get on with the show today. Here is my new friend, Thomas Flippin. All right, guys, one more thing. Sorry about this. I had to edit out the first 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes. I don't know, hell, maybe even 20 minutes of the interview. There was a big noise. They were drilling in the background. We talk about it a little bit when we come back. But basically, just wanted to let you guys know that's what's happening. So what you're being dropped into the middle of is, you know, we had to run down the street and plug in my friend's rec room because they a jackhammer went off the minute we started recording. It became really troublesome. So anyway, without further ado, here is there's plenty of material in this part, though, but every once in a while we might talk about something that, you know, you don't understand. Just know that there's 10 minutes of material lost to ambient New York noise. All right, here we go. Here's Thomas Flynn.
Announcing the audience what's going on.
Like in the Marriott now.
Okay, we are on a time budget. We actually are, it's 12:16. So Perfect. We have, isn't this amazing?
This is great. This is wonderful.
I'm glad that you got to see the hustle that does go into this shit.
People
it's
have
the,
no idea how hard you work
no,
at this, man.
They don't care. They don't care how hard I work. They consistently have refused to acknowledge my hard work. But let's talk about this. Let's talk about your hard work. You were talking about Azerbaijan. What people should know is that there was a drilling going on. Now, I'm not sure whether or not we're going to use what we talked about.
I hope so, because it was amazing stuff. Possibly the best stuff that's been on the show. But it would be a travesty if people couldn't hear it, you know?
We talked about
foam mattresses.
Foam mattresses. Black guitar people.
Being black. Yes. Black in America series, yes.
Which I'm an expert on. And then we talked about Denis Azerbaijan. That's where we left it off, where you were about to study with Denis Azerbaijan. What people should know is that we went uptown a little bit, a couple of things, to my friend's conference room. Boom, because there was a jackhammer going on. It was insane. It was driving both of us crazy.
Awful. Just awful.
Now we don't have coffee. We have no water.
There's no heat. We're in a dungeon somewhere.
But we're
fluorescent
just getting
lights.
It done. We're getting it done. So we ran out of the house, packed everything up, and now we're here. And they're going to get a little echo effect. Sounds like, just pretend we're on the stage.
Concert hall.
We're in a concert
this
hall.
This is lovely.
We're in a concert hall. So anyway, you're talking about Azerbaijan is what you called him?
In America, they say Azerbaijan. But
oh,
I've been told
Azerbaijan.
That, yeah, I think the actual Bosnian pronunciation is Azerbaijic, or
okay. I don't know.
Something like that. Anyway,
something along
sorry,
those
Dennis.
Lines. And you said that was
Azerbaijic.
When you study with your first, there's a lot of master guitarists out there, but when you study with someone who is, an undisputable master of the stage, a concert guitarist,
right.
Someone who, is one of those very few rare, consistently
excellent.
Professional guitarists
yeah.
who just, no matter what you see him do, it's going to be great.
Mm-hmm.
So what was that experience like for you?
It was scary. You feel like so
I
much
know
pressure.
That question is ridiculous because, I'm not really, I got to get the juices flowing again. But, what was it like for you to study? What did you get out of that? What happened? So
I think
you have to get in to study with him, or did you just kind of like?
I sent him an email, contacted him. He's like, "Oh, I'm away doing a concert."
You were like, "I want to get good, dude."
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And then and he's like, "Yeah, I'll be back in town after this concert. Come over, we can try a lesson out." And I did. I went to his house. I met his wife, Eugenia, and we kind of
the flute player. Right?
Yeah, exactly. They're a phenomenal flute and guitar duo, cavatina duo.
Mm-hmm.
And and we had our first lesson. I thought it went really well, but it's kind of scary. Like you're this aspiring guitarist, you're thinking about like doing it for real.
Right.
And then you want to get better. So you seek out, phenomenal players. And it takes like a lot of courage just to even contact them and like put yourself in that situation where they can like tear you apart.
Right.
And that's what you need though. You need someone
right.
to like tear you apart and be like, no, this is how you really should
at
be
at that
playing.
Age.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you're younger, you don't need that. That's the
well,
worst
how
thing
was
ever.
He, I mean, was he a ball breaker? Was he tough on you?
I mean, in a very gentle way. I mean, I don't want to say gentle, but like in a very like, friendly way that didn't
right.
discourage me.
Right.
Right. Like he'd just be like, no, like this is not how you're supposed to do it. Like do it like this,
Right.
Work harder, just, just like really straightforward.
Right.
And like really, that was really helpful for me.
Very calm.
Yeah, exactly.
He's a calm
and friendly,
person.
You know, like I never felt like he was like antagonizing me. It was always just like he
right.
wanted me to get better. So.
And he made you better.
Yeah. I got a lot better studying
how
with him.
How long did you work with him?
I think about 2 years.
Yeah.
2 years taking lessons at his house. Yeah.
What do you think is the best? I mean, this is a silly question that a lot of people ask, but it really is important. What do you think is the best thing that you got from him? Was it technique? Was it music?
Was it was
musicianship?
Technique.
It's technique, right?
Hands down.
He's
technique.
A technique master.
Yeah, he completely changed the way that I play free strokes. Just
how?
Totally. Because I had been doing like this Lorenzo Michele style of playing, you see this
very
a lot
light.
When people, yeah, very light, only using half your finger.
Right.
And then Dennis was like, no, man, you gotta use
in.
The big knuckle. yeah. and like move your whole finger and you'll get a much bigger
sound
out of the
guitar. Why were you using the Lorenzo? Had you seen Solo Duo?
No, not at all. I mean, I didn't think they were formed back then.
You were just like, hey, I think the key to this is just relaxing and playing quietly.
I think the key is to play with wimpy strokes and, you know, like have a small sound. No,
and then, right.
No, it's just, you just do things, you know, like, cause you don't know any better. And I think that's what so much of this is about, like being exposed to what's possible and like seeing how other people do it. And that's why it's so important for us to go to concerts and, you know, like meet each other and talk to each other about playing and teaching. And that's why your show's so great.
Thank you.
You know,
I hardly ever talk about technique on it, but,
oh yeah.
you know, but as far as that is concerned, that is an interesting point. I mean, you know, Lorenzo's playing is super light. I don't remember, I mean, when I saw Dennis play, it was a while, you know, 90s, I think. So I saw him on his GFA tour.
Okay, great.
So I shouldn't really say that, I shouldn't have even said consistent, because I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Did I see him in New York once?
He was out here last year.
I didn't see him last year. I don't know what I'm talking about. You know what you're talking about. You've seen him a couple of times.
I can fake like I know what I'm talking about.
And then what happened from there? So then I'm assuming you did become a music major in Chicago or no?
Yeah,
at
University
of Chicago. What was living Chicago like? What was that?
Chicago's a great city, man.
It is a really cool city.
I thought it was the best city, but then I moved to New York City.
Okay. And what are your feelings?
And, you know, Chicago's great.
Come on, it's great. Right.
But New York is better. I have to definitively say.
It's the best city in the world.
It is the best city in the world. I don't want to live anywhere
and
else.
And I know that people visit and they're like, oh, it's expensive and crowded, but just leave Times Square.
Yeah, why would you go there? Just why would you subject yourself to that?
Just try the Upper West Side.
Yeah,
just,
it's lovely.
Go up to the 80s.
Yeah, you got the you know, West Side Highway, you know, like the what do you call it, that? Where you go jogging, you know, like
nobody calls that anything. Yeah. It's just called the West Side Highway.
Just the West Side Paradise, thing. Where you can just run along
it's
the water.
It's paradise, dude. and my brother, it took him a long time. I've talked about it, you know, ad nauseum on the show, but it took him a long time to come around, but now he... Yeah, you just need enough time here. You need over a year.
You need over a year, for sure.
To really go like, oh, and then you go somewhere else. You go somewhere you thought was awesome. Like, no offense, San Francisco, but like
oh
a San Francisco.
Oh, my God,
Francisco,
I can't believe you just said San Francisco, because I had the exact same feeling.
Those are the people that have the worst attitude about cities of all time. They are under the just illusion
that San Francisco
that they
is
live
the
in
best,
a bustling metropolis that is just endless opportunities for as far as the eye can see. And they just don't understand that that city is not the size of Austin, Texas.
I know.
It's a small town.
It's a village, really. You know.
And I don't mind that. I think it is one of the best cities in the world, and I wouldn't mind living there at all. Mm. But the fact that they want to sit there and bad talk our city.
Oh.
Those are the ones the San Francisco people are the ones that think that all other cities suck. And we don't think other cities suck. We like other cities.
Yeah, San Francisco's a cool spot. You know, it's got the 60-degree weather and the ocean. You know, it's great. And then, you know, great music scene. But, you know, I used to think it was awesome. But then, you know, I lived in New York. And then I went out to visit my friend there again. And it's – I don't want to badmouth San Francisco.
No,
I should stop. You know, San Francisco's great.
It's a great town. For me to poop on. No, it's a good town. It's
good.
It's
adequate.
It's a nice – little town. No, it's a great place, but I just don't like it when people talk bad about my city.
Yeah,
and they do it so readily. They attack with this voraciousness.
Oh yeah, like I hate New York.
They hate it. Yeah. They have to prove to us that they hate.
Like, why would you want to live there?
And I'm just sitting there going, do you understand what we sacrifice to live here?
No, and it's a lot. Living here is not easy.
No, it's completely insane. And you sacrifice any semblance of a normal life is foregone, so you can live in this city with these people, and then they feel like it's okay for them to come in and go, eh, it's not for me. You know, fun to
just
visit.
Just dismiss it outright. Yeah.
I like Dylan's candy bar, but you know, other than that. Anyway, so you're talking about Chicago. You're Dennis Azabajic. You get out. How old are you at this point?
I think I'm like 21. I'm about to graduate from college.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out what I'm going to do next.
Right.
So I'm going to keep doing this guitar thing.
Yeah.
So I, you know, set out to apply. Dennis writes me a really great recommendation letter. Apply to several schools, get into them.
Yeah.
And then it's just a matter of choosing which one.
Yeah.
And then I like visited the schools. I did like a kind of incognito visit to Yale. You know, I went to like one of their performances and I got to see Ben like without talking to him, like just to see what he was like, you know, like when no one's watching, you're like, what is he actually like with his students? Because it was like a little student recital at a museum. And, you know, like this guy comes out and he's like really engaging the audience. He's wearing like this salmon sweater.
I mean,
it,
His clothing choices have always been suspect.
It was a questionable clothing choice, right. You know, but I saw
he was
that.
One of the collarless guys. He got rid of the collar for way too long for me.
But, you know, he comes out and he's, like, wearing his, like, Ked sneakers, and he's got this pink salmon sweater on, and he's just, like, really engaging with the audience, and he's, like, cracking jokes and setting up the chairs for his students. And I was like, you know, that's a really cool guy, because that's a guy who's going to, like, be a role model for you and, like, really, you know, because there are different types of teaching. Like, you can break people down and, like, yell at them about all these things, or you can kind of help them to become the artist that they're going to be. Yeah. And, like, recognize, like, not everyone's going to play the same way, not everyone's into the same music, but help you discover, like, what is your thing? Like, how are you going to contribute to this thing that we love? And, you know, that's what I loved about him. Like, instantly you could tell he's, like, an artist, not just a guitarist, not just, like, a music teacher, but he's, like, someone who's, like, really doing it, like, has a voice that's original, you know? That's what I really liked about Ben.
And how did that affect, I mean, is that what you wanted, or were you at that point, were you just trying to get good at guitar at that point?
I felt I'd gotten pretty good at that point, you know? Like, I'd gotten into the Aspen Music Festival. I'd studied with Barwaco at his Peabody Masterclass. Okay. You know, so I felt like my playing was pretty good. And then, you know, I just kind of wanted kind of more guidance.
And at that point, had you had an undergraduate degree?
Oh, yeah. I graduated with a BA.
From where?
From University of Chicago.
A BA?
A BA.
In what?
In Law, Letters, and Society, which is the fancy way that they said
so
pre-law.
You graduated with a pre-law degree.
Right. And I also got a minor in music. So.
Studying with the woman, who was your official teacher there?
And I was at the same time I was doing lessons with Julie Goldberg and then with Dennis. So.
And then with Dennis just to back it up.
So. Yeah.
And then, you know, moving on to the Yale thing, you did the incognito thing, and this was for grad school then.
Yeah. And then I actually...
What year is this?
This was 2005.
Yeah.
2005. So then I actually decided I did want to apply to Yale after seeing Ben in that context.
You'd also gotten into Aspen.
Yeah.
And so you did a Sharon thing.
I did. I spent that whole, you know, what is it, like 2 weeks? I can't remember if it's 2 weeks or 4 weeks. I think it might have been 2 weeks with Sharon in Aspen. Had a great time. Met some really wonderful friends.
Gohar, was she there? Or?
She wasn't there at that time, but I did meet Gohar for the first time at the Barwaco Masterclass.
She's younger. I think she's a little younger than you.
Yeah, she was younger. I think she was just about to start with Barwaco when I was like a junior in college.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Sorry. But as far as the Yale thing, so then you started Yale.
Mm.
You got into Yale.
Yeah.
I mean, this is actually phenomenal because you're starting late.
Mm.
Then you started. You don't have a bachelor's in music.
Right.
And then you get the master's. You go in for the master's. What do you play? How do you get? I have never heard of somebody getting a master's degree
that didn't do the BA.
That didn't do the BM. Right.
Really? Oh.
Does that happen a lot?
I feel like Sharon Isbin, Elliot Fisk, they did the Yale undergrad, which didn't have a music performance degree. So they might have majored in music, through the Department of Music. But yeah, I feel
Is that true? Elliot Fisk went to Yale?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And he actually started the Yale guitar department.
Kirkpatrick or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So.
So he was just studying with a harpsichordist.
Well, at Yale, yes.
And then, Ben, I guess Elliot started that program.
And then Ben took it over.
Yeah. What was that experience? You said that he was able to foster, you know, sort of the artist within his students. He was able to, you know, to actually give that credence, whereas a lot of teachers, like Adam was not about that. He was about becoming a better guitarist.
Mm.
I mean, I don't know if you would agree or disagree with that, but... I think that he, generally speaking, you know, he felt like his job was to make us a better guitarist. Mm-hmm. And then everything else was not extracurricular, but it wasn't necessarily his responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And he could make us artists in terms of phrasing and repertoire choices and stuff like that. But outside of that, it was just sort of the ball was in our court. I mean, how was Ben able to bring anything out of you? Well, what did he bring out of you? What do you do that nobody else does?
I guess I could think of it this way. Like, when I first got to Yale, you know, I was, like, obsessed with, like, Segovia repertoire.
Sure.
And, like, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to play my Taroba pieces and my Ponce.
Right.
And he really, like, pushed me to not do that. Like, he requires all of his students to play Bach. He wouldn't let me play anything that I had played before I got to Yale.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you had to start from scratch working with him. And then he, like, really opened up my ears. He was like, you need to go into the studio, go through my CD collection, listen to every single CD I have, and find new repertoire and push yourself to listen to new things. So when I got there, you know, like, all I wanted to play was this, like, tonal stuff. But when I left, you know, I was, like, really into Hinza and, you know, like, playing outside in, like, a jazz trip. Like, dissonant music wasn't nearly as, you know, I wasn't as against it as I had been. You know, like,
when you were against it, were you, so at one point earlier on, you felt kind of against it. You were like, what is the point of this?
Well, I was kind of just like, I felt like it was very alienating to audiences.
Yeah.
And it didn't speak to me.
No, it me neither. Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah. You know, after, when I left Yale, I realized like there is some really quality stuff that is very far out.
Right.
Now, I'm still kind of, I guess you could say, a little more conservative than other people. You know, like I'm not playing Tippett,
right.
You know, blue guitar or anything like that. Right. But, you know, I feel like there's room. I feel like you can find a balance between playing dissonance and playing like stuff that's audience accessible to you.
Right.
Yeah. And try and find a middle ground so that you're not like solely pointing at yourself when you go on stage. You know,
right.
It's like playing music that's smart in quotes, you know.
Yeah. No, academic music. Yeah. Academic atonal music that just is about something else, I guess. My whole thing is I'm going in to myself recently, and I've been addressing this issue a lot, especially since I interviewed the two guys from WQXR.
The brothers.
I've been listening to a lot of new music lately, and it's been great. I found a lot of real, you know, a lot of gems. Like Sufjan Stevens, I don't know if you ever heard of him.
No, familiar. It's just
tonal. Mm. But then every time I'm starting to realize, I'm like, you know what? I don't like that atonal stuff. I don't. It's like, I like it when a composer that can do that and still maintain a form, an idea, a line or something within that. I respect that. But my favorite time is always when those composers make tonal music.
Hmm.
Or, you know, neoclassical or something, or like, you know, there's those Ligeti pieces I heard recently performed by the Knights Ensemble, which is a local group, and they were all tonal. So it was all Ligeti that was tonal, and it was absolutely mind-blowingly perfect, you know? So but then every time that those composers decide, like the Sufjan Stevens guy, who I think is my favorite young composer,
okay.
he's doing this thing, it's called the BQE. You know, like the Brooklyn Queens Expressway.
Oh yeah.
And it's a movie. I haven't seen the movie, but he wrote a soundtrack for it, and it's great. But then there's this moment where it just gets really dissonant for 3 minutes, and I'm just like, what? Fucking skip this. Like, I don't need to listen to this. Like, this is. It just sounds like horror music sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we associate it with. Like, it's always the background track to a horror movie.
I've spent 25 years trying to listen to it and make it not horror music, but it still sounds like scary movie
music.
That's
the association you're just always going to have with it.
Well, how can people not have that association?
Like, you just wake up in the morning, it's a beautiful day, and you, like, turn that on, and you're like,
You're like, I'm going to listen to some Weyburn right now.
Yeah.
Like, no, you aren't. Like, just be honest with yourself.
And I don't feel like that's what people fall in love with our instrument for, you know? Like, I don't know of anyone. Maybe I'm wrong. I was probably going to be people listening
who are like,
you're wrong.
There are people like Dan LaPelle are going to be sitting there, and I love Dan LaPelle, and I love his albums, but at the same time, just saying, like, dude.
He's like Barrio Sequenza is what turned me onto the guitar.
Come on. Know? Are
like,
you serious?
I don't buy it. I don't buy it, man. I think Asturias is what turned you onto the guitar. That's what got you playing, and then you discover this other stuff that you're also interested in.
Right.
I mean, I could be wrong. I'm going to acknowledge that I could be wrong about that.
I could be totally wrong. I feel like 90% of people would think that we're wrong about this.
But we're right.
It's like, just be honest with yourself.
Yeah, you know, it's like...
The only people that like that are us.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, really?
Yeah.
Are you serious? Like, we're that special? Like, our brains are that... Mine's not that developed, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I've spent so much time trying to get it.
I think...
I'm still trying to get it.
I'm working on it. I'm working on it. I mean, I've done some work with jazz musicians, so like their concept of outside is like way beyond what I consider playing outside. So
right.
Like just all wrong notes all the time, whatever. And
but
it's
at
all
least
acceptable.
That's an exercise.
Yeah, but they come back, you know, at the
right.
end. And like you can go far, far out. But
right.
as long as you come back and have, you know, kind of ground it in something. So I think if you're writing dissonant music, as long as you give like a rhythmic thing, like give something for the audience to hold on to and
right.
follow along with. Otherwise, you're just like, what if you're... If you're only concerned with that stuff, like, why are you...
Oh. No, it's okay. Sorry. Don't touch the table.
I'm sorry, Brett.
I've just had it with noise at this point. I want no noise in this recording whatsoever.
If you're going to write far-out music, you know, give people something to hold on to. Otherwise, like, what is the point of playing your music in concert?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you just want to write this music that only is going to please you, then why do you want to have it performed in front of other people? What's the point?
I don't get it.
So, and I think that's a problem in our community.
And I think that there's so much more you can write that's tonal. And
of course.
That's chromatic, but not necessarily just completely just off the rails. Like, I don't know. I mean, I've been thinking about it a lot lately because I've been thinking about new music a lot.
Mm.
And I don't know. I'm glad that you actually said it and had the balls to say
it. I'm going
to
say it, man. I'm here to name names, call people out.
Burn down the church.
Yeah, you know, whatever, man.
Right.
Whatever. So, it needs it. Our field needs it.
I mean, it does. I mean, we're sitting there going, like, well, I can't get a job. Playing, you know.
You know, my Allbach recital. Oh, I shouldn't say that. Oh, no. Now I've crossed a bridge too far.
No, I mean, I've always talked about the Allbach recital being a problem. But, you know, unless you want to play. But it just seems like, again, like the Bach recital thing. It's like I just saw someone who played half a recital that was Bach and half a recital that was imaginative, and she had like all these, she'd you know, introduced poetry into it, and she was moving, she was acting, she was reciting the poetry.
That's fantastic.
She was using her face, and she had combined Brouwer, like she had played like the last movement of the Brouwer sonata, and she played a couple of Lauros peppered in, and then she would talk in between them in Spanish, and it was lovely. It was just so much fun. I was like, okay, this is what I've always said, like people need to incorporate the guitar into a larger performance framework.
Yeah.
Like that
incorporate
that,
other arts.
That to me is what every other, all the other acting and dancers, that's what they have to do. And I'm not saying there's not room for just a concert guitarist, but for all of us to be that way and then constantly compete for that is destroying us on the inside. And I'm just sitting there going, and then she struggled with the Bach. Just plainly struggled with it.
Which usually is what happens when classical guitarists play Bach. I mean, it's really hard music. You know, David Russell pulls it off, but a lot of us, you know, have a lot of trouble pulling it off consistently recital.
I've seen David Russell struggle with the jig in the second violin partita. And I struggled with it, and everybody struggles with it. And that's the problem with the Bach, is that, and that's the problem with all those multi-movement pieces, is that there's... You could play four of the movements fine, and then there's always that one fucking movement
where you're like,
I can't do that. And that's the problem with Bach, is because it incorporates all these different techniques. So, like, you can have a great breaststroke scale, but then you might have a bad descending arpeggio.
Yeah.
You just might not be in your toolbox yet, you know. And then all of a sudden, the whole fucking suite is like hinging on this one moment. I'm sorry.
Did Segovia have it right? You know, just pick one good movement, you know? Just play the fugue and then nothing else. And then play some of the hits, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe that's what we need, you know, kind of piecemeal.
Do what you can. Do what you can, man.
Yeah.
What are you doing then? Why do you, I mean, as far as like we were talking about with the Ben Verdery, you would come in there, he told you to go look at his album, you would found some of the stuff that was, further off the rails, less conservative, and you were able to get into that, which we all need that. We all have that moment where we're like, oh, I like this one Schoenberg piece.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Doing that, he introduced you to academic music.
Yeah, kind of. To push your, just to the idea of like pushing yourself to do something other than you're comfortable with, like to go outside your comfort zone. And then another great thing he did while we were there, he enabled all the students to compose as an exercise. So for that semester, we all had to write a piece of music, like an etude,
bingo,
and perform it. And it's a brilliant thing for a guitar teacher to do, because some of us will get that itch, you know? Like, we'll actually be forced to, like, write a piece of music. And I had written in college and, you know, done some stuff.
Sure.
But, like, that was my first time writing a solo piece for guitar. And, you know, I got bitten. And I just had to keep writing. And I realized, like, that's something I really want to do. Mm-hmm. And it really speaks to me. And I can write music in a style that's not really done commonly on the guitar. Mm-hmm. And, like, he helped me find that voice for myself, too.
What do you mean by that? How do you feel about that?
What do you mean?
What is the thing that you're talking about? You said you can do something on the guitar that you don't feel is commonly done when you're writing on it. And by the way, the writing thing, we could go on about.
I could talk to you for hours, man.
Yeah, me too. But as far as like the writing, I mean, the writing is, that's kind of where I feel like that's really the contribution that needs to be made. That's where we're lacking.
Yeah.
We're lacking in repertoire.
Mm-hmm.
Written by guitarists, because only the guitarist can write it where the guitarist can play it.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Like we fall in love with this instrument, but then you kind of delve into it and you get better at it and you get more knowledgeable about it and you try and find out like what music is there for this that speaks to me.
No.
And you know, let's just be real, Brett. You know, like this court music from Italy from like the 1700s doesn't speak to everybody.
No.
You know, like this, you know, not even Bach speaks to everybody.
No.
And I feel like in our community, when you say like, you know, I'm not that into Bach, it's like heresy. You know, it's blasphemy.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it's people dismiss it and say, like, oh, well, you know, just catering to the masses, you know, ignorant yeah. people. You know, my wife is, like, a brilliant, brilliant person. Like, one of the, literally the smartest person I've ever known.
Yeah, cool.
You know, and she is not a fan of Bach.
No.
And she, part of the reason she hates going to classical guitar concerts is because someone's always playing Bach.
There's at least 20 minutes of Bach
exactly.
in store for her.
And it's always, and it's always got to be 20 minutes. And, you know, I love Bach. I think he's written some of the most yeah. profound music. You know, it's always glorious. But, you know, to me, you know, and I'm a black person, so, you know, I'm like, I'm kind of looking at this from a different perspective. But, uh-huh. like, this court music from, like, a wonderful time in a colonial empire
yeah.
isn't exactly my life experience.
Right.
You know, so like the music of Prokofiev speaks to me a lot more than, you know, some of these other music. It speaks to right. me more than Giuliani. And if you like that kind of music, kind of this like dark, brooding, dealing with like oppression and, you know, like,
yeah,
I don't know, like the Soviet state.
There's not a lot of that in the guitar repertoire.
Not so much. You know, there's Giuliani and Soar, and then there's Mertz, and then you kind of fast forward and you've got your Taroba.
Right.
And, you know, got your Albanese and.
Right.
And then who knows what happens, but
and then it gets a little weird or
yeah, and then you get your far out stuff,
right?
And then you get your like modern Americana where it's like really cool and accessible,
right?
You know, but for stuff like, you know, you want some dark music that's serious and like romantic, you know, like similar to Rachmaninoff, we've got Koshkin. I mean, I guess you could say we've got like Steppen Rock, and then there's this composer Konstantin Vasilyev is writing some interesting things.
Yes, yes.
But you know, that's what speaks to me. And if you want to hear music like that and play music like that, I feel like I have to write it.
Right.
You know, I have to, like, write this kind of dark, cerebral stuff. Well, I mean, I shouldn't say dark and cerebral, but, you know, like, just a different style. You know,
yeah.
I feel like our repertoire kind of has some holes in it.
Yeah.
That cater to, like, different personality types and different interests. And I think it's, like, our job to kind of fill those holes.
100%. And like, we missed out on a lot of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah. we kind of just jump missed, over the
mess. Yeah, we just jump over. We kind of went from, like, late classical parlor music to Latin music.
Yeah, exactly.
In the 20th century. And it's like, well, we missed out on that wonderful, you know, Schubert. And, you
yeah.
know, it's like this like late romantic literature, which is really defining in Western music. And
yeah.
I always go back, when I compose, it's like there's always a part of me that's just like, I just want to just play, you know, I want to make music that sounds like Wagner.
Mm.
On the guitar,
yeah.
you know, and I know it's like, you know, silly and kind of like inconsequential, but on my album, the last track of my song is just a pretty classical piece, you know, and it's like, I don't know. Yeah, I think that you're right. I think that there's plenty of holes in the repertoire for us to fill and that people just don't do it.
And you know,
because it's hard.
Yeah.
And it takes work
yeah,
to write music. And they don't want to admit that,
that
the reason they don't write is because it's a pain in the ass to write and they're going to be spending half their day writing.
Yes. And like, just, you know, just freaking out,
yeah.
you know, all sorts of neurosis about like what you're writing and where
whether
every
it's
note
good.
Goes. Yeah.
Right.
How's it going to be received?
It's impossible.
But you know what some of the big, another big hole in our repertoire is?
Yeah.
I am 31 years old.
Okay.
And in my entire life as a classical guitarist,
sure.
I have never seen any of my colleagues at Aspen, Cincinnati Music Festival, Roosevelt University Guitar Day, any of my teachers really, any of my colleagues at Yale play pieces by women.
Okay.
And I feel like
right.
that's something like we probably should talk about. Like, why is it that 50% of the population is not represented
right.
in our instrument, in
right.
like the music that we play?
Uh-huh.
You know, and I've found pieces. There are pieces written by women, like Connie Hsu just has like a really cool CD
oh, she does?
Of female composers.
Oh, I know that. Yeah, she just did that. Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's like this cool South African composer, Jean Zidel Rudolph, who I kind of looked up her piece, which is really neat.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think most of us would say, like, have you played three pieces by a woman? I think most of us would answer no.
Right.
And like, what does that say about our fields, like, and the role that women can play in it if they're not represented in what's
yeah.
being played on stage? I think that's a problem.
Right.
So, and similarly, like, music by people who are not, you know, white and from Europe.
Yeah.
Like, that's a problem.
No, it is. Yeah. It's not inclusive.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. I think the role at the bottom of it really, though, is that, you know, we are simply just playing music that's either written by modern academics or court composers.
Yeah.
And those
exactly.
are all just rich white people. There's no doubt about it. If yeah. you're going to Yale, chances are you're a rich white guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And Ben's a great guy, too.
But he probably was, I mean, I don't know if he was a rich white guy, but seems like he probably was. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just saying, I mean, it seems like everybody, these are all people that kind of like, their families were pretty well off. Like, there is, for me, it's almost, it's a class issue. Because I come from a poor family, and I've struggled against it the entire way. I'm like, no, I can't go to a competition. Why? Because it costs $1,000 to go play for Andrew Zone in Georgia. So that I can be told to fuck off. It's like, I can't afford to do that.
Yeah, like, who has the money to, like, fly around the country, like, gambling, like, what, like, rolling the dice as to whether you're going to place in a competition and make it to the final round and get reimbursed? Like, and that's, I mean, that's
even
one of the...
Even if you get reimbursed, dude, yeah.
And, like, what are the odds of that?
The odds of that are completely slim to none.
Yeah. And, you know, that's why competitions are kind of, I feel like we put way too much emphasis on them.
Right. Because if you don't do that, though, it's like GFA's never, they don't even want to address this podcast.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. They won't even, like, they just want nothing to do with it.
Let's name all the names, man.
They can do whatever they want. I mean, I'm just saying it's ridiculous how hard you have to struggle if you're not part of that system.
Yeah.
And that system is a system that is composed of rich people.
Hmm.
You know, that I will say, because it does cost money to take guitar lessons, and it does cost money to
get a quality instrument,
and to get a competitive instrument, and it costs money to go do the competitions, and it costs a
ton of money to get your degree,
to go to college, a fortune, you know, $100,000, that's a fortune.
Yeah.
And that's an undergraduate degree.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Oh, come on.
Just take a break. What was that safe word we agreed to?
But yeah.
So let's just stay on this, man. Let's just stay on it.
Yeah, let's do it.
You know what bothers me?
What?
It's like people will say, and like in our field, they'll be serious and they'll say like, "Oh, I only play serious music."
Yeah.
And it's like, to me, that is such an offensive thing to say.
Yeah.
Because when you say that, like, there's an implication to what you're saying, like,
yeah,
I only play Western academic music.
Right.
And I am an expert, and I'm going to label any music that's not this unserious.
Right.
And, you know, like, when you say that, like, what do you mean? Do you only play, like, ragas, you know, like Ravi Shankar? Like, do you only play West Ghanaian drumming?
Yeah.
And, like, you've transcribed that to the guitar? You know, do you only play, like, Islamic plain, like, chant? Like, what are you saying when you say that? And you're just dismissing, like, you know, 90% of the world.
Right.
It, like, no one else has deep thoughts and puts that into music of their culture? Like,
right.
I feel like it's an unhealthy mindset for our community.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's a lot of unhealthy mindsets.
Well, I think that what they do is that they go, well, you know, we're not Taylor Swift. And I'm like, well, nobody's asking you to be Taylor Swift.
Like, there is a middle ground there.
There's a lot of room. Like, it's like, we're not asking you to be Bieber and Swift. We're just saying, like, maybe, you know, the program, like we said, shouldn't always be exactly the same.
Yeah,
it was so refreshing to see this person perform the second half of the program, and it was just so shocking that the first half had happened at all. You're just sitting there going, like, why? Mm. Why'd you do this? This isn't you. Like, this isn't, obviously the second half is very you. Mm. You're exactly right that people just, I don't know. I know that it's our fault. I feel solely responsible for it. But I feel like, yeah, the infrastructure is just basically great technical players.
Yeah.
And then they don't want to let anybody else in. The women issue, I don't know, man. I mean, I don't know what I don't really know any women. I don't know any women composers. I mean, but they, at the same time, is anybody searching them out? I mean, can they, devil's advocate, where are they? Like, why aren't they showing up? I haven't seen them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what my duo is trying to do. Like, we're trying to, so I have this duo.
So what do you have to do? You got to go fly around looking for women?
You kind of, I mean, I know some from grad school. Like, there's this composer, Missy Mazzoli, who's writing music, and she's written some stuff. Usually the composers, you know, at that level are writing for, like, electric guitar.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's about commissioning.
Yeah.
You know, finding talented female composers. Like, there's this cool composer who...
it's about commissioning.
Yeah. And you have to ask people to be included in this world that we care about.
Yeah.
Because if you don't make the effort to bring people into it, then they're not going to feel that there's a place for them.
Yeah. There is a difference between somebody with talent and somebody with hustle.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, the most talented people are going to have just not that much hustle in them.
Yeah.
They just aren't going to be able to do, like, just what we just did, run down the street in the middle of the day on a Friday with a computer in their hands and, you know,
and make that work somehow.
Jump into a friend. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They don't do that. That's not part of their wheelhouse. They're you know, introverted mm-hmm. often, stuff like that. So yeah, you're right. I mean, if we would just go out there as the performers, mm. right? As the ones who can get on a stage
and
communicate with an audience. Yeah. That is, I guess that is something we could do more of reaching out to them.
So, I mean, it's worth thinking about. It's worth thinking about.
Now, as far, and then, you know, we were talking, that's the women thing. As far as the race issue, you know, you were talking earlier in the program about, like, just never studying with any other African-American guitarists. And like we said, there are some black guitarists out there, but generally they're not from America.
Right.
I mean, do you just feel like, again, is that just not us reaching out to the community in the right way?
That's a hard one. It's a hard one to know whether it's like it's a clash issue or it's just, I mean, I hate to say things like, oh, it's a cultural issue mm-hmm. because, I mean, that's also a loaded thing to say.
Right.
But, you know.
I mean, it's going to change.
It's changing. Oh, it's definitely changing. Yeah. I mean, I've seen way more African-American, you know, young students coming up in guitar programs all across the country. But when I was coming up, you know, I'd occasionally seen like older African-Americans, but they were always amateurs.
Yeah,
you know, amateurs. Like they were going to festivals.
Yeah.
But they were amateurs.
Yeah, I've seen that too.
And
now that I think about it.
So for me,
but
like,
I've never seen
I was
like a peer other than you.
Yeah, I mean, when I was coming up, it was just I was always like the only one playing at that level.
No.
And I was so happy when I got to Yale because my last year there, I met Chris Mallett, who was also African American, and we formed this duo together.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And you know, it was just really nice to not be like the only one that you know of in the entire country playing at that level.
Right.
You know, like that can be a lonely road.
Is it really? Does it feel lonely?
It feels, you know, like we all have so many issues to deal with when you're on stage already. But then to like have this like extra thing where it's like, how are people perceiving me in this like predominantly white, you know, cultural system?
Are they thinking about it?
Yeah. And like, are they coming with all sorts of biases or like expectations? And what
you better do good.
Yeah, exactly. And like, and like, if you play badly, you know, it's not just like, oh, I would feel in my head. I don't feel this way so much anymore, but I would feel in my head like
when you were younger and fierier. Do you think you felt it more? Like,
I think so. When you're first coming up, but then you like you get old enough.
Because
you
have all these
concerts.
Emotions and you have to put them somewhere, and you know, like you can put them there.
Yeah,
I'd imagine.
So I'd assume the worst, and I'd assume like if I had a bad night, that people would be like, oh, it's because he's black.
Right.
And that might be like a completely ridiculous thing. And it's all in my head. But I mean, as artists, we have these things in our
head.
Not
all the time, though. I mean, it's probably, some of it's probably real. Hmm. Like, you know, I mean, that's not coming from nowhere. Like, I'm not saying that people are doing it or that they're not doing it. Hmm. But I mean, yeah, like I would imagine that, especially in some parts of the country, people are very aware of it.
Yeah.
I mean, like here, it doesn't really process, but, you know, you go down south or something like that, it might be in the back of your head. Although the artist community, the artistic academic community, it doesn't seem like it's going to be.
Yeah, it's a pretty loving place, you know.
Right. But it's just, it is interesting that there aren't as many.
You would expect.
You would expect more.
Because, I mean, it's not like there aren't black classical musicians.
Yeah.
You know, there are fantastic black classical musicians, you know, like, and opera singers.
Opera singers.
You know, I mean, there's tons.
For years, forever.
Yeah, exactly. Like, going back, you know, early
1900s.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I feel like it's changing now. And I feel like any small role I can play in, like, kind of helping to bring that about would be, like, a good achievement for me to look back on.
Did you meet, who's the other guy in your
course? Chris Mallett is
Chris
my duo
Mallett.
Partner.
Okay, and now I know him from something else, too. How else do I know him? He's your duo partner?
Crime Report? I don't know.
Crime Report. Here we go.
He's kind of a devious person, so.
Is he really?
No.
No, I don't know him from a Crime Report. Helicopter overhead. But he, where is he from?
He is also from California. So we both were these like black classical guitarists that grew up in Southern California.
Right.
And when we both ended up at Yale and just bumped into each other at the Norfolk Music Festival.
Now, speaking of racism, let's talk about Orange County.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you must have experienced it there.
Oh, man. I went to a high school with, it was like 2,000 students and three of them were black.
Oh,
so, you know, that was really fun for me.
Yeah.
You know, it was never like really overt. Well, no, that's not true. It was overt at times.
Yeah.
Like on the sports teams. I mean, I'm not going to get into the things I was called.
You don't strike me as an athlete. You know? Like you look very slight.
thank you.
Yeah, sure. I mean,
so
well, people think I'm
very
an athlete.
I'm like
this big fat guy, and people are like, hey, this guy obviously, you know, I'm like, no, I can't throw a football. I can't catch a football.
Mm.
I'm scared of a football.
I'm terrible at basketball. People always think I'm good at basketball because I'm tall and, you know, lengthy. But
now I'm good at basketball.
Oh, well, maybe you can coach me or something.
Oh, but anyway, so people think because you're tall and lanky, they're like, yeah, he's going to play some.
He must be a mean basketball player. And I'm actually like one of the worst basketball players you will ever meet. You know, like I try and throw trash into the trash can and I miss by like 10 feet.
Yeah.
I'm awful.
Oh, see, yeah, dude, I'm actually really good at it. Just yesterday, I met a student. He goes, I'm going to assign you something out of the court book, too, if I make this. And he goes, okay, well, what if you don't make it? And I go, if I don't make it, you get one last page out of the lesson book. He goes, awesome. And I made it. And it was like from here to that chair.
Oh, that's like a good 15 feet right there.
I could have been. No, I'm horrible. This is the way my sports career ended. I don't know if I ever talked about it on the show. But when I was a kid, I was on the team. I was the worst player on the entire basketball team. So I'm sitting here talking about how great I am. But when I actually played with other children, I was always the worst, like the worst, number zero.
But when you were playing solo basketball,
when
you
I
were
got
awesome.
A little bit older and I was like, oh, I can actually move my body. I'm like, okay, well, yeah, I can figure this out. And then I got a little bit better at it when I'm just playing around with friends, you know, the park or something. By the way, I talk like this if I ever actually had a pickup game. The last time I played a pickup game was at the park, and we played with the kids, and the adults were playing behind us. We didn't play with the adults. We just played with the kids.
It's safer that way.
Me and the guy who lives in this apartment, Chris, just went out there. We were like, they look like they're throwing the ball hard. I didn't want to break my fingers. But what happened was is I'm sitting there, and I the whole season went by, and I think it's the sixth grade, and I'm sitting there. I'm trying. I got my shot. So I get it off the backboard, take it up with a layup, and score. And I scored for the other team. I scored for the other team. The worst part is my parents were there, and the girl I liked who was dating one of the assholes on my team, one of the guys that was great. And I got along with all my team members. They all loved me because I was, you know, fun and funny and stuff like that. But I looked at her, looked at my parents, and I just went like, yeah. And then I look back and all my, you know, did like a fist bump to myself and everybody's laughing. Everybody's laughing.
Oh my God.
I look back, the other players on my team are just kind of like, some of them are laughing, some of them are pissed, you know, because they're competitive kids. And
so that was a career killer for
that
you.
Was
that's,
it.
When, that's when you knew was, basketball was
like,
not for you.
I go, my head is just, I can't do it. And then my head's so not in the game that like, I score for the other team. Like, who does that? And who also fist bumps themselves when they walk up after scoring for the other team. It's like, yes,
I did it.
But yet I have the look of like kind of a bigger guy that, you know, could take a hit or whatever. I don't know. And when I got in fights, I would just cover my head. I'm just like this tiny little
sensitive
pussy.
Artist. That's yeah, what we are.
That's what we are.
That's what we're supposed to be.
And so, but in Orange County, you know, there was nothing too overt, but sometimes in
uncomfortable,
parents.
Very unpleasant. And not with parents, but with the students, you know, like... It was
well,
unpleasant.
Students are just assholes anyway.
Yeah. And
they're mean about everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And here I was like this little kid like teaching himself classical guitar in his spare time.
What is up with this guy?
Yeah. He doesn't fit any of our stereotypes.
What does your wife
do? She's a pastor.
Oh, she is?
She's got a church in the West Village. She's a Methodist pastor, a big liberal progressive church.
Great.
Yeah. And that's what she does.
Are you religious?
I don't know if I should talk about it.
Oh, no, that's okay.
No, I'm just, I am spiritual.
Okay.
I grew up, you know, in my family, I have three uncles who were pastors.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, I grew up in, you know, in the church, you know, in the black church, you know, like, and, you know, now I'm very supportive of my wife, but, you know, I'm a spiritual person. Like, I'm kind of a more agnostic, like, I don't profess to have the answers about these things, but what's cool is...
But she does.
Yes.
Professionally,
she knows everything. Like I said, she's brilliant.
Was she she theology the whole thing? She's been doing it forever.
Yeah, yeah.
She's
met in college at University of Chicago.
That blows me away how smart those people are. I mean, it's like I just don't get like because I feel like it's I just don't get where they're coming from. Religious people, especially preachers that are like our age.
Mm.
Like I'm always like, are you serious?
How do you have the answers?
Like what happened? Come on now. But like so she's. But like you said, she's very smart, very intelligent.
Yeah, and she's smart in a way that she knows, like, she doesn't take the Bible literally.
Yeah.
Like, she views them kind of almost like Thomas Jefferson did in, like, the Jeffersonian Bible, which...
Did you guys see Book of Mormon?
We have not. It's our dream.
I just saw it.
You just saw
it? We bought each other it for Christmas.
Oh, see, that's the only way you can see it, right? When it's, like, a big splurge on
it. We were like, let's just... It's $180. I was like, okay, well, you know what? Let's just do this instead of you buying me a PlayStation and you know, or something, you know, or an iPad for each other or whatever. I was like, let's just do that.
Was it worth the wait?
Dude, 100%. But it's like scathingly. I mean, it's not just about Mormons. It's like scathingly anti-religious.
Oh, really? I thought it was. I never heard that. I thought it was just about the Mormons.
I think the whole point of it is like just sort of like a, just like you know, it's like a, it's kind of like a South Park episode, but it's also like just sort of their opinion on the whole thing.
Okay.
So before you guys see it, just know. But like you said, she's a progressive.
Yeah, she knows like how ridiculous some of these pastors you see on television are.
Yeah, she's not doing that.
Yeah, she's not
she's
like
helping.
At all.
She's trying to help.
She's like working in food kitchens.
Giving people hope.
Yeah, well, yeah, hope, support. You know, she deals with a lot of alcoholics who come and like sleep on her church steps, you know, so.
Wow. Wow.
So, yeah, so she's not like a caricature of what a religious person is. Like, she's actually like making the world a much better place.
Yeah.
And that's why I respect her so much, because it's not like this preachiness thing. It's more of a kind of how am I going to live in a moral way like Jesus Christ did.
Yeah.
Which might be a little off topic for this show.
No, not at all. I think a lot of us are, you know, especially as we get older, you know, I mean, we're sitting there, we're going like, okay, is this it? Like, even it doesn't matter what level you are in your career. You know, I mean, I don't ask myself, is there a God so much, but I am always asking myself like, you know, when I'm in those moments of darkness, I'm like, okay, so what the fuck? What am I going to do? Why am I doing this?
Yeah.
What's the point of all this? And there's really nowhere for me to really turn because I'm not religious.
Mm.
I'm sure a lot of the, you know, maybe the listeners, it's just nice to know that you, I mean, like you're able to actually get along with her and she's not really constantly barking at you to get on board with it.
Yeah, not at all.
Amazing.
Somehow we make this interfaith relationship work.
That's
know?
Beautiful. Yeah. Interfaith. That's right.
That's
what I'm. That's the only thing I'm starting to do is I'm starting to get more vocal about my atheism, I feel like.
Oh, okay.
You I know mean, there's I mean? The movie. And not aggressive. I'm just saying, like, I'm an atheist. Like, I work at a Jewish school, and, you know, maybe the kids will ask me. Mm. And I used to say, like, I don't talk about that. But I kind of just say now, I'm like, no, I'm an atheist.
That's great.
And I feel like it's important for me to be able to say that. And I feel like, you know, so the kids know that atheists, you know, don't just, you know, piss on each other with, you know, in an orgy, like just, or you're a nice little guitar teacher, man. So anyway, as far as, I just heard from, you know, we're going to wrap up here pretty soon, but I just heard that you were on the cover of Soundboard magazine. Is that true?
That is true. Rumor confirmed.
And this is like just this week's or whatever,
yeah,
this month?
Yeah, like this quarter's, yeah. So it came out end of January.
What's your article about?
So we did this arrangement.
I don't subscribe to Soundboard magazine.
Oh, the truth comes out. Not a member. Okay.
Not a member. That's my problem. Never a member. Go ahead.
So this article just came out.
But congratulations. That's really exciting.
Yeah, we were real excited about it. You know, I mean, it's a big
Oh, it's about the duo.
So my duo, Duo Noir, we trying to broaden the repertoire of our instruments. So we researched this great composer, Nathaniel Dett, loved his music, made an arrangement of one of his most popular pieces called Juba. Uh-huh. From his In the Bottom Suite, which is about Southern plantation life, post-slavery.
And so is it an arrangement of his music?
It's an arrangement, like okay. Really a transcription.
So what did he write it for?
He wrote it for piano, and we transcribed it to two guitars. We had to make some changes to make it work, but it's like a really fun and, you know, like audience-friendly piece. It gets flashy at the end, mm-hmm. and it's like really good on the guitar. Like really, really good, and it like fills a hole in our repertoire, because there's not really this kind of folksy, you know, like plantation sing-along music mm-hmm. in our field that you hear a lot of guitar ensembles playing. You know, maybe there's tons of it, I don't know, but I haven't heard it. So I was really proud of it. So like we made this thing and then we wrote this article about it and like who he was, how he played at the White House.
Okay, so they had you write the article.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay, because that's what okay, so now I feel bad about giving them shit. Because they were like, oh, we'd love you to write an article. And I was like, well, then it's going to sound like I'm talking about myself.
Well, maybe. But the article was about this other person, so it wasn't just us.
And it was
like,
such a good article that they were like, this is the cover.
Yeah, I guess so.
And the photo was pretty cool, too. What else are they going to talk about? That's like they're all another Anna Vidovic sitting there in a dress?
Yeah.
In a satin gown? Like, we've already seen it. Profile of David Russell in a blouse?
Yeah. And
already seen it.
I give him credit for that, because they're in a blouse. You know, like I think it was cool. I think it was a bold move to put us on the cover.
Yeah.
You know, because... Who are we, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And like, you know, it was interesting.
No, well, I mean, what you did was interesting. Yeah. What you did is unearth, you know, a composer. What you did is you transcribed the music, and you have a duo, and that's it. You're all set. Yeah. Who are you? I'd rather that be on the cover than the same old suspects, the usual suspects or competition winners. So congratulations.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that.
I hope good things are going to happen.
Fingers crossed.
I know they are.
I'm trying not to muck it up too bad.
Well, I'm super glad that we're friends.
Likewise.
I think this is good. I mean, we've hung out maybe once or twice.
Yeah.
But
very harrowing hangouts. Until 2 a.m. before, like, I had to go teach the next day, I think, at, like, 7 a.m.
Oh, so. You had to do a 7 a.m. Saturday? What, yeah, was that the up. Adam Holzman concert
then? Yeah, that after that hang.
Because everybody's drinking whiskey.
That was a fun hang.
That was a lot. I came a little late because I had to go, you know, haul my old teachers, my old maestros bags around. But, you guys were on some of you drinking... I mean, there was like liquor. It's like a lot of liquor.
It was some good times.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah, they don't always get that way.
Yeah, I love guitar hangs like that.
I do.
Where everyone's chill and it's like not competitive at all, and
not
we're just
competitive
like
at all.
Talking about things other than guitar, but also talking about guitar because we're all guitar nerds. But
yeah, you know, it's funny because the only time that I get competitive is when I'm not around them, and then the minute that I'm around other guitarists, I'm like, this is the best. Like, finally, I'm talking to people that, you know. Understand me.
Yeah, exactly.
And don't think that I'm a genius that's just about to become famous, which is what all my other friends are always like. We just know that you're going to be fine. And I'm like, I'm not going to be fine.
I'm going to endure.
Right. I'll endure this life. Anyway, this has been a very, you know what? The last time I was in this room, I forget what the guy's name was, but it was a young guy and we got dark too.
Real? Oh.
Yeah, we were like talking about how we mistreat our girlfriends.
Okay.
Like how we're not nice enough to them.
Uh-huh.
And it went on for 15 minutes. So there is something about this conference room which really
brings out
the
worst.
Fire.
Yes.
In me.
I'm glad we could share that with everybody.
All right.
This.
Well, thanks so much for joining me. And we're going to get
thanks
you
for
on
having
to work.
Me, man.
You're a Diller Quail. Is there anything else you want to talk about real quick? You got anything to plug?
Yeah, I'm gonna plug away. So Duo Noir, we just released this CD last summer. It's called Figments. It's some great compositions by this Juilliard composer who's a good friend of ours. It's 35 minutes of like groundbreaking post-minimal guitar music for two guitars.
Cool.
It's really interesting stuff. There's not a lot like it in our repertoire. It's gotten really good reviews in like popular new music blogs like I Care If You Listen. Check that out. Duo Noir, Figments.
I Care If You Listen. I don't know about that blog.
Oh, this is what all the non-guitarist new music composers read.
That's a play on that I Don't Care If You Listen.
Bingo.
Milton Babbitt.
Article. What's that other one? Oh, I'm thinking of something else. Yeah, I think
I just talked about it in the last podcast. I think yeah, so that's what a clever idea. I got to read that.
Yeah.
I'm really getting into new music now. I'm like just digging around.
Are you doing
around.
The WQXR,
I'm digging
man?
Around looking... No, I'm digging around by myself looking for tonal composers.
Mm. Well, let me know how that works, because I'd love to play that stuff.
Right. So I have to get through about, 90 CDs of crazy stuff, and then I found, like, one gem that a composer wrote once. That's kind of... I think that's my new sort of, like, weekend activity.
Lifting, lift people up. Find a good composer, lift them up.
Looking for them. That's the point. Find a good composer, lift them up. Thanks so much for joining me, Thomas. Have a good day at work.
Will do.
All right, guys, thanks for joining me. This is Thomas and Christopher from Duo Noir performing a piece by Raymond J. Lustig. This is California off the album Figments. Just came out, in 2014 there. And this is what we were talking about. Beautiful collection. I bought it, and I bought the whole thing. And I'm enjoying it. Tonal new music. Who knew? Anyway, I'll see you guys next time with Mark Del Priora from the Manhattan School of Music. He taught a lot of you. This is a big guest next time, so make sure you join us. I'll see you guys in 2 weeks for episode 51. That's episode 50. 50 episodes in the tank. All right? I did it. Here's to another 50, right? Unless I go into advertising. Talk to you guys later. Advertising doesn't want anything to do with a 38-year-old anymore.